Boston and NPR. I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. For millions of Americans and much more, video games are the immersion, the escape, the fiction of choice. Worlds to conquer, to traverse, to share. A new release is a big event. A year's worth of games is a lot to choose from. This hour on Point, the best video games of 2015 and where the world of gaming is going. We'll talk with two top video game mavens and with Ken Levine, creator of BioShock. You can join us on air or online where this conversation is always on. Is this your world? Halo behind us here. Is this part of it? What's great this year? What makes it great? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. And listeners, some fine news. iTunes has named the On Point podcast to its best of 2015. If you miss a broadcast, our podcast is always there. Subscribe at iTunes, Stitcher, wherever you get your podcasts. You can link to all that at our website, onpointradio.org. And so, to the games. Later in this hour, we'll talk with Ken Levine, who led the creation of the games BioShock, BioShock 2, BioShock Infinite. He'll tell us about his next release. Susan Arendt joins us in a moment. With us first from San Francisco is Danny Dwyer, host and producer for GameSpot, which has news and reviews of video games. A lot of gamers follow Danny O'Dwyer. Danny, thank you very much for being with us today.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me. 2015 was a really wonderful year for games, and I'm very excited to talk about them.
What makes a wonderful year for games? I mean, we know when the Academy Awards roll around and we look at the Oscars and sort of size up, was it a good or bad year for movies? Well, when the National Book Awards come out or we sit down with critics, we sort of know what to expect with the measures that are put up against a crop of books for a year, literature. In the gaming world, what makes a great year, Danny?
That's an interesting question, actually, because gaming is sort of an emergent medium, and it's really coming into its maturity, I think, over the past, you know, 5 years, maybe decade. We don't have that sort of top tier, I guess, looking down on what the best games are. We have an awards show, quite a new one. It was on 2 weeks ago, the Game Awards in LA. But I think, personally speaking, 2015 was a wonderful year in games because of the variety of experiences that were available for players. You know, games are very subjective experiences, and the things that appeal to one person may not appeal to another. And this year we had a variety of really sort of wonderful open world single player experiences that you could dive into for, you know, over 100 hours if you had the time. And we also had shorter multiplayer experiences that you can sort of pick up and play either with somebody on the couch beside you or with some friends or strangers over the internet. And then on top of that, there were some good games coming out for the Wii, Nintendo's console, which sort of appeals to a smaller subsection of the gaming audience. And then, you know, mobile games aren't going away anytime soon either. So this year, this certainly seemed to be something for everything.
We want to dive into all of that. Let's get a little bit of the sound of it. This will sound, I think, kind of line up with what people expect in the video gaming world in a way. This is Call of Duty Black Ops 3, a sci-fi first-person shooter video game, 12th in the Call of Duty series. That is a lot. Takes place in 2065 in a world rocked by climate change and technological advances. Post-apocalyptic settings, very common in the video game world. Follows Black Ops soldiers. Its predecessor, Call of Duty Advanced Warfare, was the top-selling game last year. This new game just came out in November.
Mothership inbound. Flag carrier down.
UAV, ready for deployment.
Enemy flag acquired.
Profit requesting eyes on enemy positions.
Danny O'Dwyer in San Francisco. Okay, this is a pretty big game, and it kind of adheres to what non-gamers, I think, will think of as a stereotype, that it's guys and guns and shooting. Is that still the essential formula in this realm? How big a part of this world is that genre?
I'd love to be able to tell you that that's not the case anymore, but no, Tom, guys with guns shooting cells at the end of the day. And Call of Duty Black Ops 3 has been well received by fans. But essentially, when we look at these games specifically, Call of Duty and say the Halo 5s as well, these are sort of the, you know, AAA big blockbuster movies of the video game world. This is your Transformers. You know, it's probably not going to make critics like me jump for joy because we cover these games every single year, but it's got that big mass appeal, which is comfortable to people and familiar, and that's why it sells so much. And this game, like previous iterations in the series, has sort of the best of both worlds. It's a good value package. There's a, you know, narrative-driven single-player experience, which can be completed in less than 10 hours, probably closer to 7, which is fun to pick up and play, especially for, you know, people who maybe grew up playing games and don't have as much time as they did in their youth. And then it also has a large multiplayer community where people sort of jump into games which last anywhere between between 4 and 10 minutes, and essentially, you know, have digital combat over the internet. And so it's a game that people tend to buy every year in the same way that folks buy, say, Madden Football or FIFA Soccer. And that's why it tends to sell every year.
Single player, multiplayer, they're both very active. Multiplayer really growing by leaps and bounds. Denny O'Dwyer with GameSpot joins us from San Francisco. We're looking at the best video games of 2015. Danny, stand by. Susan Arndt joins us as well right now from Durham, North Carolina. She's managing editor at Games Radar Plus, has reviews and playing tips and buying advice for gamers. Susan, thanks very much for being with us today.
Oh, well, thanks for having me on.
Danny says it's a great year for video games. Do you agree?
Oh, it's a phenomenal year for video games. No matter what your skill level, your budget, your taste, there is something really fantastic for you this year.
Give us a sense of the range. How much is grab a gun and you know, go to work with the bloodletting versus any and everything else?
There are a lot of mature games, and a lot of games do focus on combat of some sort, but there are a lot of games that are more about experiences or storytelling. There are a lot of family-friendly games that are out. There's even a game called Splatoon that takes the typical shooter mechanic, which is something like a Call of Duty or a Halo or something that's traditionally a lot more violent, and it makes it very, very family-friendly and bright and colorful. Instead of being soldiers, you're kids with paint guns, and you're shooting ink all over the arena, and that's how you win, is by getting the most ink all over the place as opposed to shooting the most number of enemies.
Splatoon. So when I hear that word, I think of blood going everywhere, but it's actually squid or something, or yep. squirting ink all over the place.
It is. Well, you're a kid. And yet you can also be a squid. When you can swim through the ink, which is all different colors, and you turn into a squid when you do, and it makes you go faster. And, yeah, you've got paint guns and paint rollers and paint brushes, and it's just very, very bright and colorful. And it's the same kind of really fast-paced sort of gameplay, but in a blood-free environment.
Danny O'Dwyer, when people get in the mood to be engrossed in a fiction or a fantasy, they have a lot of options out there. I mean, you can go into a book, you can go into a movie, you can go to music for that matter. What is the particular appeal of video games? When all those options are before you, what's the appeal that takes so many people to the video game quadrant?
I think when video games do it right, there's nothing more engrossing than a game. I guess the main differentiator between video games and lots of the other mediums you just mentioned is that video games are interactive, and in that way you can take ownership of the story. And that doesn't just mean, say, you know, like a choose your own adventure book where you decide which direction the story goes, you know, which predetermined direction. Oftentimes that means, you know, you making choices which you don't really know if that's going to make a difference. Oftentimes it does, and oftentimes it doesn't. But it's in that sort of that vagueness that of not knowing, just like in everyday life when you choose your sandwich in the morning and you don't know if you're going to get a stomach ache. In the same way, in video games, those games that sort of give you that narrative choice but don't force it down your throat, that's something very, very powerful. And we had a lot of games this year which did that effectively. My favorite of which being The Witcher 3: Wild Hunt.
The Witcher 3: Wild Hunt. Describe it to us, Danny.
It's essentially Poland's version of Tolkien. It's a series of books written by an author called Andrzej Sapkowski, who wrote this. You know, it's essentially high fantasy. And the game, as we play it, is the third in the sequence. But I would definitely encourage anyone who hasn't played the other two or knows nothing about this to pick it up, because it's entirely playable on its own terms. It's essentially a big open world fantasy game where you play a witcher, a monster hunter called Geralt of Rivia, and you have this. You're on this search for your daughter, but while that's happening, there's also a sort of a war happening in the land around you. It's a vast open world with lots of different environments, lots of different people to meet along the way. And while you're on sort of one quest, it's very easy to be dragged in different directions for all these different side quests as people in the world sort of come to terms with war or whatever is going on in their day-to-day life. Just to give you an idea of the scale of this game, Tom, when I completed the single-player story, which was probably, you know, maybe half of the content of the game, I run up 120 hours, and I endured every minute in it.
120 hours, that gets to very big book territory, maybe of volumes and volumes. Derek in Canton, Ohio. Derek, you're on the air. Thanks for calling. You're on with Danny O'Dwyer and Susan Arndt.
Hi, Tom. Hi, guys.
Hi.
I just wanted to talk a little about like the immersive video games. I think, hands down, the best game I've ever played was The Last of Us. It's basically you're a guy and a girl going through the apocalypse, it's almost like you're part of a novel. You get to watch the stories unfold. You get to make decisions that affect the entire world around you. But the entire time I played it, I was on the edge of my seat. And there's a lot of games that are coming out like that where, you know, what you do directly impacts the end of the game. And I think, you know, games are taking a very indie approach to experiences rather than just running around and shooting people. You know what I mean?
Yes, indie in that you're setting your own path through the game, Derek?
Right, right. I mean, The Last of Us kind of had a finite ending, but the way it plays, you know, you have to scavenge to make weapons and tools to get to the next part. And then it went even more in-depth with the downloadable standalone game that came with it. Because you play as a little girl, she's only grown up in the apocalypse, but you get to see her playing in a photo booth and telling puns, and it really hits you that she's just a kid. It's a powerful, moving game.
Derek, I love it. From Canton, Ohio, video games as novels in which you are an actor, in which you are immersed. Danny O'Dwyer spent 120 hours in a single game. Listeners, what are you doing on the gaming front this year, 2015? What have you thought was really the top of the heap? A little sound here from Rocket League behind us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the best video games of 2015. For many, these are now an art. We're looking at what's hot, what's emerging in gaming. Gamers, what are you loving this year and why? What makes a great game, video game, for you now? And what games are at the top of your list this year? Tell us why. Explain the magic. Are you lost in Rocket League or The Witcher 3, Halo 5, Until Dawn, Splatoon? Lovers in a Dangerous Space-Time. I love some of these titles. Danny O'Dwyer is with us from GameSpot in San Francisco. Susan Arndt joins us, managing editor at Games Radar Plus, with us today from Durham, North Carolina. We'll hear in a minute from Ken Levine of Bioshock fame. And we've got lots of folks who want to offer their suggestion. Here's just a little sound for those of you who aren't in this world. League of Legends, you work with a team. Lots of multiplayer games right now. This is a huge one. You look to bring down an opposing team's nexus. The game is free to play, but you pay for characters called heroes you can use in the game. As of last year, more than 67 million people played this game, League of Legends, every month. Game's being constantly updated. They put this video out in October to explain how you choose your character.
You'll start by choosing one champion from a list of many, all of whom have their own unique strengths and personalities. Some are ranged marksmen, pelting their opponents from a safe distance, or burly fighters who like to get up in their opponents' faces. Others are arcane mages, casting powerful spells to trap and damage their enemies. However you like to get things done, there's a champion out there to match your style.
Danny O'Dwyer, Susan, help us here. Danny, when you get into these games with huge numbers of players, you've got different styles. Sometimes you're just out there multiplayer, lots of people. Other times you're in a team. Where do you find what, Danny?
League of Legends and Dota 2, which are the two sort of MOBA games, what we call them, are, like you said, absolutely huge. In fact, Dota 2 had a tournament a number of months ago, I think it's third or fourth annual iteration of it, which had a prize pool of $16.4 million. So this is big in terms of people playing it and also in terms of spectators. And I guess the easiest reference to what these are is it's kind of like competitive chess. They're games where you have a large degree of strategy involved, but sort of more, maybe more like speed chess, where you're, instead of it being turn-based and one person has a go and the other one does, it's all done in real time. And instead of there being two competitors, there's five on either side. And I guess there's two very interesting things that come out of this, Tom. One of which is that these are games which are, more and more we're finding, I believe, that there are folks who are playing one game quite a lot and not maybe necessarily playing lots of games like they did in the past when games were shorter. League of Legends came out in 2009, so it's actually quite old, but you wouldn't know that because they keep updating it. So this is one thing we're seeing a lot of in games. Games as services, essentially games where people play them and then new content comes out for them all the time. And in terms of League of Legends and Dota, these are also games with quite high barriers to entry in terms of skill. You know, I'm a professional talking about video games. If you put me in front of Dota or League of Legends playing the average player, I'd get absolutely destroyed. So they're very, very rewarding if you're in those communities, but it can be quite difficult to get into those communities in an industry in which there is already significant barriers to entry in terms of controllers.
Susan, talk about the skills required to thrive in these games when you're playing against the whole world, 67 million people on in a month. Susan's sound is giving us a trouble there. Danny, the skills set that you're thinking of there.
Yeah, so each character, you know, you move them around the map, as it were, the plane, and then each character, each hero, as they call them, has a unique set of abilities. So, for instance, some of them might be good at ranged attacks. That's, you know, attacking with maybe a bow and arrow from far distance. Some may be larger, lumbering characters that have big weapons that can be used in close quarters. And then generally, there's an element of sort of magic as well involved. So, essentially, imagine, you know, when you're playing a game of chess and you put a bishop up against a rook, you sort of know what they're going to do, or at least you know what they could do. So imagine that, except every character has four or five different things they could do instead of one, and instead of there being just a normal set of characters on a chessboard, there's actually somewhere closer to 40. So it's sort of high strategy that's played out in real time. So these games, when you watch them, they can kind of look, you know, very bombastic and exciting, but it doesn't really look like there's a lot going on. But there's actually quite a large level of depth of strategy happening. It just can be quite difficult to see it.
Trevor in Lowell, Massachusetts. You're on with Danny O'Dwyer. Trevor, thanks for calling.
Hi. Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I was wondering what everybody on the panel thought about Undertale and how a game that's so peaceful and so simplistic and was made by mostly one guy, Toby Fox, how that really impacts them and what they think about that and that kind of effect on the industry.
Undertale. Danny, do you know it?
Yes, Undertale's had quite a large response in our office. It's essentially sort of a homage to old role-playing games. It looks something like something you'd see on an Amstrad or a Commodore 64, developed by an individual as well, which is something that's really exciting, I think, about video games, is that we're seeing what sort of happened in film in the 80s and 90s, where individuals, you know, the cost of developing and the skill set required, they're sort of reaching a really nice equilibrium where people can make incredible sort of experiences that you really only would make if you were making it on your own, you know, as opposed to a massive team with lots of different ideas. Undertale sort of speaks to the nostalgia and, I guess, the way we think about games. And games have been around for so long now that there are sort of very set rules, or we think about games, we sort of know how they're going to play out. And Undertale subverts that very, very cleverly. I think it's for a particular breed of gamer. I think folks who have played sort of old role-playing games in the past specifically enjoy it. For me, it's more exciting as a sort of a use case for, you know, how wonderful games can be, that you can enjoy a game like Undertale, which was made by an individual and, you know, speaks to a very particular audience. And you can also, in the same breath, enjoy a game like The Witcher, which is 120 hours of running around chopping monsters' heads off.
Amazing. We go to Bioshock's Ken Levine in a moment. Susan Arndt and Danny O'Dwyer are with us. Justin in Atlanta, Georgia. Justin, you're on. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom. Hi, Danny. I was just going to kind of go back a little bit about what Danny was speaking of earlier concerning the AAA titles, not really giving critics much to think about. Some of these games, like Black Ops 3, where it's basically just guys with guns shooting at other guys with guns, don't really offer anything new to the gaming industry. It's the same old tire track that we've seen for years now. Instead, what I think that a lot of gamers are really wanting are more games that are games as art. One of them that comes to mind is The Binding of Isaac Afterbirth, which was just released a few months ago. And that deals with story elements that you wouldn't find in a AAA title. Things like the dark adages of religiosity, especially fanatic religiosity, child abuse, things that you're just not going to see on an everyday title that's released in a major PlayStation or Xbox.
Justin, did you say The Binding of Isaac Afterbirth? Did I hear that right?
Yes, that's exactly what I said.
Susan Arndt, are you with us from Durham? Do you know this one, Susan?
I am. And one thing I want to point out, when we say that gamers want games that are more art, I mean, keep in mind that Call of Duty and Halo, if gamers didn't want them, they wouldn't sell. And they keep being made because they sell. Now, that said, I mean, Call of Duty each new iteration of the past several years hasn't done quite as well as the year before. So it may be that that formula is getting a little bit stale. It's also important to keep in mind that a AAA game costs millions and millions of dollars to make. So it's not going to, you're not going to get millions and millions of dollars thrown at an experience like Binding of Isaac, which does address more interesting issues than just, hey, can you kill more people than the other team? But we also get experiences like Soma, which is a game that asks you to consider the nature of consciousness and existence and what makes us human. You get games like Life is Strange, which examines teenage-girl relationships, which is not something that gets covered in games very much, and also deals with things like cyberbullying and suicide and, you know, mental health issues and stuff like that. So there is a range of experiences to be had, some veering more towards the artistic or more thought-provoking, and then some going more towards the direction of shooty-shooty bang-bang.
Yeah, Susan Arndt, Danny O'Dwyer, please stand by. We've got Ken Levine with us right now from Boston, co-founder, former creative director of Irrational Games. Big name in the business, led the creation, and in the creative side of this, led the creation of the games Bioshock, Bioshock Infinite. Ken Levine, welcome back to On Point. It's great to have you here.
Hi, Tom.
What are you working on these days? Where are you headed in the gaming world? What do you see as the next frontier?
Well, you know, something that's been happening this year, and it's something I started thinking about a couple of years ago, that you're starting to see sort of the AAA single player narrative game is starting to disappear. You know, kind of games like Bioshock, that there's fewer of them being made. And the real reason is they're very expensive to make. And I think gamers are saying pretty loud and clear that if they're going to spend $40, $50, $60, they want more than an experience that lasts more than 10 to 12 hours.
Okay.
You know, that's a lot to ask somebody to spend.
So what does that suggest, Ken?
So we started this experiment, you know, after we finished Bioshock Infinite, which was how do you make a narrative game, you know, kind of feel like the kind of games we've made before, but make it replayable and make it extend and make it react to the players, make it replayable by giving the player different ways to approach the problems and letting them really dictate the experience. That is not a simple problem to solve.
Does that mean an open world game, the phrase Danny's used a couple of times, or something else?
Well, it can mean an open world game. And the thing we're working on is sort of a small scale open world game. And the reason ours is an open world game is because if you want to give the player the agency to drive the experience, that really fights against sort of the linear natures of the games we've made before, like Bioshock and Bioshock Infinite. And so what it really means, though, is how do you make your content so it feels like the sort of quality of a content that you've made in games before, but reacts to the player's agency and allows the player then to do something in one playthrough and something very different in another playthrough. And the sort of solution that we've come up with, when I say solution, Tom, the game's not done. And, you know, we could have some very nasty surprises down the road.
Yeah.
Is to break down the narrative bits, and this is going to get a little wonky here, into what we call, what we've been calling sort of narrative Lego. And now think of Lego where you have a, instead of like getting in a complete, like when I was a kid, I had the Star Wars playset, and it came as a big chunk, and it looked like the Death Star, right?
Yeah.
But I also had my Lego. And my Lego were small little pieces of content, you know, these little cubes and these little spheres and things like that, that you could combine in interesting ways to make lots of different things. So we're trying to make this, craft this custom narrative content, but in small chunks that can then combine in millions of interesting ways.
Ken Levine, does that mean that I have to be interested in engineering this game every time I play it, or does it somehow randomly spread out before me?
Yeah, we as the creators will be building the formulas that tell the Lego pieces how to combine. So it's not like a Minecraft or something like that where the players are literally building the narrative. But the Lego pieces have to combine in response to the player's action. And the end goal, you know, that's a lot of sort of complicated game design speak. But the end goal is really to have a narrative that plays out differently based upon what the player does, to give the player that experience of this is a great narrative experience, but I'm going to play it again, and it's going to feel different each time.
Danny O'Dwyer, Ken Levine's a big name in this world. If he's headed there, will people wait for that, go for that?
Yeah, I think that's the sort of the exciting new frontier we're looking at. For, you know, these open world games, Tom, a lot of them are quite what we would refer to as sandboxes, where essentially they are large open worlds, but ultimately what you're doing in lots of these places is the similar thing. So narrative driven games have been linear for decades, and reason being is that, you know, I imagine making dynamic narrative games is very, very difficult when you hand the player over to when you hand those controls over to the player, and the different permutations that can happen when you make any choice. Obviously that's just incredibly complex. But what we're seeing now, and it's exciting me so much as somebody who loves single player narrative-driven games, is that more of these open-world games are... people are figuring it out. Like, game design is an incredibly complex thing. I'm sure Ken can tell you that more than I can. But we're starting to see developers all around the world really sort of grapple with this and figure it out. And as somebody who, like, I love Ken's games, Bioshock Infinite, for instance, as a narrative-driven game, it was the same experience that everyone had in terms of its content. But there are elements in that game about Irish diasporia, which I'm sure as somebody who grew up in Ireland, like, it affected me in probably a way it didn't affect 95% of gamers. So when there are themes in these narrative-driven games which can appeal to individuals, but then also, you make games in which there's narrative freedom for you to explore and sort of find your own stories and find things that might affect you that only you ever found. I think what we're finding then is really, I guess, the end game, which is these worlds that feel like real places and that your actions feel like real actions that impact on them.
Susan, are you hearing this from players, this clamor for the ability to find recombination, narrative freedom?
Oh, absolutely. Players want to feel like they are impacting these worlds. We've gotten to the point in video games where the worlds that we're running around in feel like real places. The people that are in them feel like real people. We begin to care about them. They're expressing emotions and pulling emotions out of us. And so the next step is we want to feel like we have impact on that world, like our actions matter. You do something in one town and three towns over, it has an impact, just like it would in the real world. You want to feel like you matter, like you're important. And in a video game in which you're the star, that's even more important. So linear story-based experiences tend to be linear because the developers want to make sure that you are getting the story that they intend you to get. Uncharted, which is a really fantastic series of really wonderful stories and ones that connected with me personally, is very, very linear. Everybody has the exact same experience. But you end up caring about these characters, and so it would be really great to feel like you were impacting them or impacting their relationships or being able to influence what they do or what the impact that they have on the world around them.
Ken Levine, it sounds like you've got your finger on the pulse again. What are you coming out with, and when? How far along are you?
I don't really know the answer to that question.
Oh my, what a world.
I wish I had some clever response, but who knows? We're working on it. We've been working on it for a while. And, when it's done is really the answer.
Ken Levine, co-founder, former creative director of Irrational Games, led the creation of Bioshock, Bioshock Infinite. Ken, it's great talking with you again. Thanks so much for joining us for a minute today.
Thanks, Tom.
Susan Arndt with GamesRadar+, Danny O'Dwyer with GameSpot. Please stand by. We're looking at the best video games of 2015, and we will dive into those after a short break here. A little music from Star Wars Battlefront, Gordy Hobb here behind us. Of course, it's out last month in time for the movie this month. This is On Point. We'll be right back. Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point. We are talking this hour about the best video games of 2015. A little soundtrack from Until Dawn behind us there by Jason Graves came out in August, getting pretty good reviews. Danny O'Dwyer is with us from GameSpot. Susan Arndt from GamesRadar+. You can join us as well this hour. Gamers, what are you loving this year and why? What makes a great game? And compare, if you would, Force, a great game to a great book, a great movie. What's it do for you? And does a great game make you wish the game was your life? We've got lists. We're going to go on through, and we'll put them up at our website as well, onpointradio.org. Lots of feedback online here. Susan, Danny, Donnie agrees with you. Danny says, The Witcher 3, nothing else compares. While we're thinking of it, let's play a little bit of that. Here, this is a little bit of The Witcher 3 Wild Hunt. You mentioned it out of Poland, I think you said. Shows us the inside of, here's one of the developers, with the inside of his creation describing the game's setting. You follow a demon-hunting warrior, Geralt, as he battles beasts and plays cards, explores his world. Came out in May.
This is Novigrad. It's a living, breathing ecosystem of thousands inhabiting its corners. Everyone in the city, all thugs, beggars, lords and peasants, have their day and night activities and pastimes. They make all of Novigrad's four districts unique, characteristic places, worlds within a world to explore.
They're talking about The Witcher 3. We've got Matt writing to us here on Facebook, says he loves Metal Gear Solid 5. Metal Gear Solid 5, what a name. It has deep, near-perfect gameplay and a dense story that is stretched across nearly all of video game history. Susan, that's on your list. Here's a little sound from Metal Gear Solid 5, The Phantom Pain. Hey, Susan, describe this to us. It's an open-world action game. Well, it's in, Afghanistan and Africa. What's going on here? Why does it make your list, Susan?
Well, it's a really well-crafted game, but it's also a very significant game. The Metal Gear Solid series has been going on for over a decade, and this is the end. This is the end of that story. And so it ties together a lot of narrative threads that have been going on through many games, and ties it all up, and it's the swan song of this particular franchise that people are very, very attached to. This is the first game in the series that is this big open world. It lets you do, in addition to the story missions, you can do all sorts of other things, like building up your home base and Fultoning people to it. You attach a balloon to them and essentially kidnap them, which sounds kind of mean when you say it like that. You can collect animals, you can have a zoo. It's a really great send-off to a series that people have been very, very attached to for a very long time.
Danny, we've got Gus writing to us here saying he and his friends have been playing Halo for a decade. How does that work? How do you stay in? Or maybe that is just exactly the way it works. Once you're in and you don't want to come out.
Well, I mean, that's why they released Halo 5, because 1, 2, 3, and 4 had people playing it for so long. Like what I was saying earlier about some games being for, you know, services that they sort of add to, and then the realities of big development, like something like The Witcher, like Susan was saying, you know, it takes so much time and effort. They come out every once in a while. Companies are getting very, very clever at developing games on a sort of, if not annual, then biannual time scale. So fans of this game in particular, Halo 5, I think it really strikes a chord with sort of folks in their maybe late 20s, because the ones who played Halo 3 back in its heyday were in college, so there was a lot of people who were playing Halo 3 back then, and I think 5 does a good job at sort of, resting on what made Halo 3 such a great game, with some pretty new interesting multiplayer modes, and then a story which takes control of the main character, Master Chief, and then also a sort of a secondary character which looks at the other side of what is a relatively complex narrative.
Gus writes to us, says, video games are art, just as powerful, if not more powerful, than books, movies. Critics don't give games the same level of respect they give movies and books, often criticizing as a childish pastime, but the story, production, and art direction of a game like Last of Us is comparable to any big-budget movie. Will you argue with that, Danny, or are you on the Gus beam there?
I mean, I'm a games critic. I'm somebody who loves games to pieces. I think what I would do is change that sentence slightly and say video games can be art. You know, not all games are art. You know, maybe in a broad sense you could say they are, because they are creative endeavors which are, you know, created to be put out into the world and for people to experience them. But, you know, some of them are just, you know, business. Call of Duty is a game that is quite difficult to argue is art. But I think what we're seeing is there's a thirst for games which, I guess, aren't sort of the usual traditional experiences we had in the past. It'd make us think about the worlds in which we inhabit and make us think about ourselves. And I think in that way, games can be incredibly powerful. And what's happening now, I think, Tom, which is very, very interesting, is that there are ways in which books can really appeal to people in the way only books can. You know, there's a way in which music mm-hmm. can affect us in a way that only music can. And now I think developers are figuring out ways in which games can affect us in the ways that only games can.
I misspoke earlier when I said Gus was talking about playing Halo. It's Miranda. She writes on Twitter, "My friends and I have been playing Halo together for over a decade, even if we can't all sit on the same couch anymore. Mm. Do not need to." Susan, what about the gender breakdown here? A male, female, Miranda and her friends love Halo for 10 years now. But is it still heavily a male market for video games?
Just as many women play video games as men do.
Straight up. I just honestly ask. I have a kind of stereotype in mind of guys doing this, but it's right across gender.
This is the thing. Like, if you think it, there is that stereotype and there is that picture of, you know, the dude bros smack-talking and shooting each other online, but turn to your left. Whoever you're looking at, they play games. You probably have games on your phone right now. Everybody plays games. They might not think of themselves as a gamer, but everybody plays games just about every day. So this notion that we have that it's just for kids or it's just for dudes or it's just games where you shoot each other is a very antiquated image. It's for everybody, and everybody is playing it, and there are a broad range of experiences that you can have. And, yeah, girls love shooters, too.
Let's get in here with people who play and love. Justin in Newport News, Virginia. Justin, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I want to express my love for the Metal Gear Solid franchise as a whole. As one of the callers earlier indicated, that this is the last Metal Gear Solid game we are ever going to get.
What makes it great for you, Justin? You're professing your love for it here. We want to understand that.
Well, the last caller mentioned that this game had an incredible open world. But for me, the Metal Gear Solid series has always been about incredible storytelling. It tells a very epic scale story involving characters who are very larger than life. I compare it often to Greek mythos, like the mm-hmm. Iliad and Odyssey type stories.
Mm-hmm. You sound like you have an active imagination that could go in lots of direction. What do you get from the video game that you might or might not from a book or a film, Justin?
Well, you get a commentary on the interaction between the player and the game, and the Metal Gear Solid series in particular has been very big on this. A lot of what makes the gameplay tick is that it is talking directly to the player about how he relates to the game itself.
You mean, is the game actually perceiving how you're playing and then responding to you on that basis, or is this canned commentary that will come at you no matter who you are playing?
Well, it is a little bit of both, but the games have always been very, for instance, anti-war and anti-nuclear weapons. That's a big recurring theme in the games themselves. So one of the things it encouraged you to do is complete missions with no kills, with just incredibly stealthy. Don't kill anyone. Don't get spotted. Don't get noticed. And that offers the highest reward.
There's a mindset. There's a perspective, and it comes at you. We see and hear and feel how hypnotic and engrossing that can be. Justin, I really appreciate your call. One more right here. Cleveland, Julian, you're on the air.
Hey, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah, what do you like?
So it's Until Dawn for PlayStation 4, and what I really love about it is, unlike other games like Call of Duty where, you know, you die and then you're immediately back and there's not really any stakes to it, the game's all about trying to get eight friends to survive through an entire night on a mountain. It's a horror game, so you've got to make choices and try to make sure that everyone survives until the morning.
And it works for you. Until Dawn, Julian, thanks. Susan, this is a kind of a slasher film sort of setting where you have to survive until dawn.
It is. This is one of my absolute favorite games this year. I am a huge horror movie buff, and this is when you're watching a horror movie, a slasher flick, and you're shouting at your screen, "Why are you going into the attic, you idiot? Don't you know you're gonna what a stupid idiot you are? You're gonna die." Well, now you have the opportunity to control the actions of these friends who are in this ski lodge, and you get to make the choices, and you find out it's actually a lot harder to make it through one of these situations than you'd expect. You control the different friends one by one, and you get to choose. Do they go into the attic, or do they try to call for help? Do they take the flare gun or do they give the flare gun to their friend? And each one of your actions has what the game refers to as the butterfly effect. And you might not immediately realize how that is going to impact your future, the future of your friends, or the end of the game. So there are a lot of different paths to take through the game. It is possible to save everybody, but you probably won't, at least not the first time you play it.
Until Dawn, here's a little bit from Will Biles, the game's creative director, explaining a scene in this game where you essentially control the characters in the equivalent of a B-slasher movie, two people surrounded here by very aggressive deer.
You have an axe in your hand here. You could have just gone and hit that deer with an axe. We chose not to do that just now, so it's just a choice. If you had have chosen to do that, the story would have branched dramatically at that point, and we would be going down a very different route now.
Your choices make a difference. And here from Fallout 4, fifth installment in the Fallout series, takes place in Boston in the year 2287, 200 years after a nuclear war. Here a character emerges from a vault that saved him to discover his old robot still functioning. Came out in November.
Codsworth? You're still here. So other people could still be alive, too.
It's worse than I thought. You're suffering from hunger-induced paranoia. Not eating properly for 200 years will do that, I'm afraid.
Fallout 4 in the year 2287, 200 years after a nuclear war. Let's go to New Orleans. AJ, you're on the air. Thanks for calling, AJ.
Thank you, Tom. How you doing?
Okay, what do you love?
The game, the way it is an open world, like y'all are touching on, and throughout the game, as you play, the different decisions you make has a different outcome.
Which one are we talking here, AJ? Fallout 4, is that yours?
Yes, sir.
Okay.
Yes, sir. Fallout 4.
And so your choices make a difference, and why do you think it pulled you in?
I played a couple of the Fallouts before this one, so I wanted to see where the game was going. And it touches on that, what the guy was talking about earlier, the Lego building. If you have four different choices in each conversation with a person, so if you come up talking to a person, you can make four different choices, which has a different outcome. And as you go through the game, that has a bunch of different outcomes in the hours that you play.
So outcomes and what effect of your choices? That is a very compelling thing in life and in a game. When we have agency, when we can change it up. That's powerful. AJ, I appreciate your call. One more right here from Nick in Miami. Nick, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom. How are you?
Okay. What do you like, Nick?
Well, I heard you talking about Dota 2, and I had to chime in. I've invested around 5,000 hours in the past year and a half, so I can definitely say
5,000 hours. You're astounding me.
Yeah.
Give us a sense of the game, Dota 2.
The game is essentially a 5-versus-5 team-oriented game. Like the guy suggested earlier, it's sort of like a competitive real-time chess, but with 150 characters to choose from, and you can only choose 5 on each side, each with, you know, different abilities. You know, the permutations of all the different combinations that you can do is, you know, amazing.
Nick, you played 5,000 hours of this in the last...
As far as the match goes, it'll only run 45 minutes, so if you only have a little bit of time, you can still play.
Hey, I have to ask you, has it changed you as a person to play 5,000 hours of Dota 2?
I'd say it's less like a game and more like a sport, so I suppose if you could say playing 5,000 hours of soccer or football changes a person, this is sort of the same thing.
Nick, I appreciate your call. Susan, I know that's on your list. We'll put these lists up at our website, onpointradio.org, Danny O'Dwyer. Dota 2, not out this year, but very big and very popular this year. Susan, another big popular trend is people watching people play video games on Twitch stream or wherever they go. What's up with that?
Well, if you think about it, it's very similar to people watching football. Right? You've got football teams who study each other's strategy and they try to figure out the best offense to counter a defense and score points and win. That's the point of a football game.
But in a football game, they're running all over the field and there's action and people's bodies flying and playing a video game, you're basically sitting on the couch, right?
Well, you're not looking at the person playing the video game. You're looking at their screen. So you're seeing all the action on the screen. You're seeing the heroes and their strategy. You hear the players talking to each other. And so they're watching it much like you would watch any other sporting event. They have favorite teams, they have favorite players, they like to learn strategy by watching, and it's just as exciting for them because they, if you don't understand the rules of football and you try to watch it, it's probably not nearly as much fun. Same thing with something like League of Legends or Dota. If you understand the rules and you can see how strategies are working or not, it can be incredibly dramatic and incredibly exciting, just like any other sport.
Susan Arndt has Bloodborne and Fallout 4 and Rise of the Tomb Raider and Super Mario Maker and Rocket League and more on her list. See the whole thing at our website. Danny O'Dwyer's got Rocket League, StarCraft 2, Star Wars Battlefront, Splatoon, Lovers in a Dangerous Space-Time, and right on down. Danny, this world is so big, it's hard to traverse enough of it here in a single hour, but it just keeps growing, Danny.
It does, and I think it's incredibly exciting for somebody like me who's played games my whole life and is now in the very fortunate position to be able to talk about them to people like you. I think if folks are interested, if this piques their interest, like people who game, they know all this. All the folks who are listening who play video games, they know exactly what we're talking about. But if you're somebody who's a little bit interested, even if you think you mightn't want to play, if you just want to peek your head in, you should go over to GameSpot.com and check out our top Game of the Year awards, which are currently running. We're counting down the top 25 games of the year.
That sounds great.
And learn about it there.
We're just about out of time. Danny O'Dwyer at GameSpot in San Francisco, thank you so much. And Susan Arndt with Games Radar Plus. Full lists coming up at our website, onpointradio.org. Thanks for joining us. Happy playing. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.